At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. First of all, and as always on a day like this, deep, deep breath. Everybody all right? But also, you kind of had to know this was coming. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 24th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, no, I know 1,000 points ain't what it used to be. And sure, the fundamentals of this economy are mostly strong. But Wall Street reached right out and grabbed our attention today. Nonetheless, not at all pleased with the COVID-19 news. Maybe what's most called for right now, though, is a little bit of context. So here goes. Andrea Eisfeldt is a professor of finance at the Anderson School at UCLA. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So you saw things happening this morning, as we all did, and you thought what?
I thought, oh, no.
Okay. Yes, there's that. But did you also think what took them so long? Because it's not like the coronavirus hasn't been bad news a-coming for a while.
That's right. I did think a little bit, you know, why now? I think it has to do with the fact that we saw this, you know, pretty major outbreak in Italy, and they actually canceled their biennial festival. Seeing that kind of contagion to Europe, which I think we actually should have expected, but it does seem to freak people out a bit.
Can you contextualize this for me just in terms of the global environment? We're coming off a trade war. Well, the trade war is still going on. We've had a phase one deal, right? There is slowing in the global economy, and now this. Discuss.
Yes, I think given everything else that we've seen, I think investors really want to see good news, and I think they were seeing everything with some rose-colored glasses. But we have had some bad news. We have had the trade wars. We have had this coronavirus as another disruption to trade, and also just potentially troubling for China, which is just such an important economy these days in the global space of things. So I think people are finally waking up to, you know, the world is not as rosy as we would maybe like it to be.
With the all-important caveat that one ought not check one's 401k on days like this, if I'm in, you know, Ottumwa, Iowa, what do I do with this news today?
Keep watching what's happening, but don't rebalance your portfolio. Absolutely not. We want to be long-term buy and hold investors, not reacting, especially not selling on bad news.
Right. Speaking of long-term buy and hold, can we spend 30 seconds on the bond market, please? It is now incredibly cheap for the federal government to borrow money. The 10-year, which we talk about on this program all the time, is at like 4-year lows. When you look at the bond market as opposed to stocks, what do you think?
I see a flight to quality there. I see an inverted yield curve, which I think the Fed will be paying, you know, very close attention to. I think we have a very nimble and very well working Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just going to ask a little game I like to play in this program sometimes. What is Jay Powell thinking in 5 words or less?
I'm watching the inverted yield curve.
That was 6, but I'll take it. I'll take it. That's a good one. Andrea Eisfeldt, she's a professor of finance at the Anderson School at UCLA. Professor, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
It was fun to be here, Kai.
Just to add a quick explainer to Professor Eisfeldt's contextual wisdom there, that thing she said about the inverted yield curve, Usually in the bond market, the interest rates, that is the yields on longer-term bonds, are higher than on shorter-term bonds. It's a sign of economic confidence. What we've got now, though, is shorter-term treasuries, the three-month bill specifically, paying a higher yield, again, that's interest, than the 10-year bond, which is to say it's a sign of maybe not so much confidence. So that's the thing that she thinks Powell is looking at, which is probably true. But speaking of which, confidence, that is, as we have said, I cannot tell you how many times on this program, a good chunk of this economy rides on the waxing and waning confidence of the American consumer. So tomorrow morning's report on said confidence is going to get a thorough going over. The coronavirus hasn't really been a thing in confidence so far. We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out from our bureau in Portland, Oregon, to do some asking around about that.
At a transit station not far from downtown, I met Lincoln Baron Holmes waiting for his bus. He works as a costumer for TV shows. I asked if he's thinking about the coronavirus.
Honestly, I am not worried about it in like a deep, visceral way.
He says the epidemic's on his mind, but doesn't impact what he does with his time or money.
It doesn't touch my day-to-day life that much. I'm not planning international travel.
So far, U.S. consumers are hearing about global supply chain disruptions and now the stock market. Santa Clara University finance professor Mayor Statman thinks at some point it's likely clusters of COVID-19 cases will show up in major U.S. cities.
The psychological impact of it that gets close to us is likely to be more threatening. You are afraid to come close to people, to go to the movie theater or stadium.
And Baron Holmes was thinking about it at a Blazers basketball game last night.
It crossed my mind while I was there just because I was in a big group of people.
Steve Schrader is starting to worry about his personal economy. He's visiting from Bloomington, Indiana, where he runs a vegan ice cream business.
My biggest product is coconut milk. Unfortunately, a lot of the places where coconut milk comes from, I really hope that we can figure out this and get a vaccine soon, you know, and there's too many deaths and it's scary.
Schrader's already concerned about his ice cream sales this coming summer. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So that's confidence coming tomorrow morning, 8:30, I think, Washington time. Otherwise, as I said earlier, 1,000 points ain't what it used to be, but it is still something. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to continue right now with our series, Reimagining the American Labor Force. 10 people in our construct, roughly matching the characteristics of all 164 million of us who the Bureau of Labor Statistics includes in the workforce. 10 people we are profiling with this question in mind. They're the ones making this economy work, but is this economy working for them? This is the United States of Work.
There's always things that you don't like about your job.
You work hard for what you want.
You know, every job has your ups and downs.
Whatever good job means.
I like the hustle. I like working fast.
It's not a career. It's a lifestyle.
My name is Scott Anzalone. I'm a family physician in rural Logan, Ohio.
Not familiar, are you?
So it's a small town about an hour south of Columbus, about 7,500 people. And it's a quiet, great place to raise children.
Scott Anzalone, he's 51, has lived in Logan for 20 years. He's an Ohio native, so is his wife, and like he said, he's a family doctor.
I'm the last one in private practice in our area, and actually in most of southeastern Ohio. There's a couple others, but I'm the last one in Logan in Hocking County.
To be clear here, there is a small hospital in town, so it's not like he's the only doctor around, but he is the only one running his own practice in a renovated old building right downtown.
Been built in 1867. The original owner owned the stagecoach company. They went from Pomeroy to Columbus, and they lived there, and that was the stagecoach stop.
Just like two of the people we introduced you to last week, Michael Durant, the CPA in New York City, and Stephanie Silverman at the movie theater in Nashville, Scott Anzalone fits into the slice of the labor force that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, calls management, professional, and related occupations. They're about 40% of that 164 million people, by the way, the biggest slice overall. And with his business, Stagecoach Family Medicine, Dr. Anzalone ticks another box in our types of worker checklist. Like about 9 million other Americans, or a little more than 5% of the workforce, he's self-employed.
My philosophy in my office has always been to provide 90% of the care that walks through my door. So my scope of practice is pretty wide. The biggest part of my practice that's difficult is offering employees competing salaries. When everybody's employed by large systems, they can offer huge benefits and, you know, all the perks and pluses of being employed, and I can't. So it's been tough making sure I keep staff and keep them happy.
It's actually an interesting point that not only are you a primary care physician, but you're running a small business.
Right, right. I'm the owner, I'm the employer, I'm the physician, and I'm also the plumber sometimes.
Right. So. Would it have been easier for you if you had just been in Columbus working for a medical group instead of out in Logan doing what you do?
Not really. I think when I came to town, everyone was in private practice. That's just what we did. There wasn't all this corporate medicine. Everyone has either getting out because of the cost and not being able to compete as well. But a lot of people don't want to have to deal with the business end of medicine. It would be easier in the sense that I wouldn't have to worry about, you know, hiring an employee or firing an employee or dealing with, you know, the internet when it's down and we'd have no medical records and those things, yes. But I also have the flexibility to, because I am the boss, if you will, I have the flexibility with my time some. I also have the flexibility to treat my patients the way I feel they should be treated, not how the corporation tells me to treat them.
Back up for a minute to that whole internet thing. You are out in rural America. We hear all the time about how that part of the country, writ large, right, that slice of this country does not have internet. That's a business impact for you?
Oh, it definitely is. Many of our parts of our county don't have good internet service. Actually, just today, my own home just got upgraded for the first time in forever because we basically had such bad service. We'll see how much better it is. But where I run into a problem is, you know, when I had paper charts, unless there's a fire, basically, I had access to my patient records. Mm-hmm. And occasionally, we'd have our power goes out. It's not uncommon for it to go out. And when it goes out, I could light my lanterns and open my charts and see my patients. Now, when the internet's down, we are dead in the water. I mean, have nothing.
You have a second job as well, right?
On the side, yeah. I work for Ohio University. I'm on faculty down there. I teach medical students. And I also run a third-year longitudinal integrated clerkship program.
Do you do it because you want to or because you have to?
Well, I do it because I do. I love teaching. That's why that was the origin of it. I love rural medicine, and this program I designed it to encourage our young new physicians to go into underserved areas, either urban or rural. But also, it also allows me to have some benefits through the university, some dental and eye insurance, and it allows me to get some time in the state teacher's retirement system. It's not a lot. You know, my retirement is what I can save myself. And this was just another little avenue that I could actually hopefully build up enough in my nest egg so I can retire someday.
How's it going recruiting young doctors to take up rural practice? I mean, have you asked some of the, you know, your best and brightest graduate, mm-hmm. have you said to him or her, hey, come on down and be a partner in my practice?
Oh, yeah. I've been looking for a partner for at least 3 years now, and I've sent letters out. I hit every residency locally. We have a couple small rural residencies, and we just can't get anyone who wants to come to a small town. They don't want to go into private practice. They're being told they can't. They shouldn't. They can't afford to. Our medical students are coming out of college with – medical school with, you know, average $300,000, $400,000 in debt. And, you know, they're afraid they're not going to be able to pay that back if they're in rural family medicine.
It's a little sad. I mean, what are you going to do when – so you're 51. You're going to work for another 20 years plus or minus, right? What are you going to do when you retire? What's going to happen to your patients and their care?
I don't know. And that's been my dilemma at this point is, you know, I have between 3,500 to 4,000 patients.
Wow.
And
that's a lot of patients.
I'm stretched. It's a lot of patients. And I have to sleep at night, and there have been times I'm like, I can't keep going at this pace, and I need some help. But I've had other opportunities presented to me, but I'm like, where are my patients going to go? We don't have someone to take that. And when you work in a community, a small community, I mean, you don't just punch in and punch out. You don't work 40 hours a week. It's not a, I always tell my students, it's not a career, it's a lifestyle.
So that was Scott Anzalone, the seventh stop in our 10-person journey through the American labor force. Coming up tomorrow.
On my days off, I'm kind of a little sad that I'm not at my branch with my people.
Number 8. Remember, you can check out all 10 people right now and read about how we picked them at marketplace.org/work. Coming up.
If you speed up the machines, the needles overheat. So you can't just like make the machines faster and faster.
Fast fashion can only go so fast, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, I mean, it had to be the Wawas, right? Really didn't have a choice. Dow Industrial's down 1,031 today, 3.5%, 27,960. The NASDAQ down 355, 3.7%, finished at 92.21. The S&P 500 off 111 points, triple sticks, 3.3%, 32.25 there. Biggest one-day percentage loss for the Dow and the S&P 500 in 2 years, by the by. Firms, as you might imagine, with big China exposure moved lower. Apple down 4.7%. Chipmaker Qorvo gave back 1.8% today. Energy stocks stalled as well. Chevron down 3.9%. Bonds, we were talking about bonds with Professor Eisfeld. The prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus fell to 1.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. In immigration news today, this item from the front pages of the Wall Street Journal, the Trump administration, the paper reports, is planning to raise the caps on the number of foreign seasonal workers. The president's been doing all he can to limit legal immigration during his term, but with these seasonal jobs, it's been a little bit different. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Joe Durkin is already thinking about summer. He's been operating Mr. Softy ice cream trucks in New Jersey for more than 20 years. In 2017, he didn't get the temporary or H-2B visas he needed, and more than half of his trucks went silent.
I ran a skeleton crew, and I lost a lot of money.
He says it's really hard to recruit locals.
When they hear, oh, you mean that job's done in October? That's the end of it.
H-2B visas are capped at $66,000 per year, but the law allows Homeland Security to nearly double that. This year, the administration reportedly plans to allow 45,000 additional workers. For seasonal businesses like resorts and landscaping, a visa lottery application is no guarantee. Peter Kramer is an immigration lawyer in Boston.
You know, there's much, much higher demand for the visas than there are actual visas.
The Trump administration has allowed more seasonal workers each year, but is restricting legal immigration in other ways. Just today, the public charge rule took effect. It allows the government to deny green cards to people who are more likely to use Medicaid or other programs. Alan Hyde teaches immigration law at Rutgers University. He says H-2B visas are a safer bet for the Trump administration.
They're reasonably well regulated. They're not the visa that's thought to be particularly subject to abuse.
He says more H-2B visa workers go back home. And Durkin, the ice cream truck owner, got a good spot in the lottery and expects to get the visas he needs to keep slinging those rainbow sprinkle cones. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We talked a little bit at the top of the program about the markets and coronavirus, consumers as well. So how about a little B2B now, business to business? If you're a company, American or otherwise, truth be told, depending on a China-centered supply chain, things aren't great. So we decided today would be a great time to hear from Gretchen Blau. She's the customs broker we've talked to a time or two, working for Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania, where it is literally her job to help American companies move product around the world.
I mean, we're known as a company that likes to think outside the box, and this is really, you know, any available option is truly thinking outside the box at this point. We have customers that ship to China, have some finished work done, and then the parts come back. Well, some of them are in panic mode because a lot of them operate on just-in-time inventory. And when your inventory flow shuts down, you know, so do your product lines. If you need parts to manufacture with, they're not getting here. We've had our office send us pictures and video of what things look like over there, and Shanghai looks like a ghost town. There's no one on the streets. It's very sad and it's very concerning for us that we have so many people over there working for the company. And, you know, of course, we're concerned with their health and everyone's working from home that can. So it's just it's a very sad situation. It just seems like the trade war was bad enough, but it really didn't have this kind of impact on the shipping. People, you know, still didn't have options sometimes of sourcing from any other place but China. And now everything is screeched to a halt out of China. A lot of the major airlines have shut down until, you know, the end of March into April. So ocean freight seems to be, you know, the major option. But then you're looking at, are there people available at the port to load the freight? So the trucks that have to get the freight from the factories to the port is even at a bigger premium because of the travel restrictions and the quarantines. We're finding that rail between China and Russia is the only thing that truly remains open. So that's not a lane we typically utilize, but we're looking at all options available at this point because everything is so tight. It's just kind of crazy, but if they didn't want to change their sourcing before, they definitely are looking at it now. So, you know, it's one thing to pay too much for them, but it's another thing to not have them at all.
That was Gretchen Blau talking to us from Logistics Plus out of Erie, PA. Paris Fashion Week starts today, and in addition to the rich and famous at the actual shows, fast fashion companies are going to be keeping a close eye on what goes down the runway so that they can crank out lookalikes for the not-so-rich and famous. But the fast fashion business model, make a whole lot of any given garment in the hopes they'll sell, could be in for a shock with what's called made-to-order manufacturing. Products are custom-made for one person with the perfect fit and look after they click buy. A whole slate of startups is trying to make this the next big thing in fashion. Megan McDowell wrote about it for Vogue Business. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
How are they doing this? Because scale seems to be a problem, right?
Right. And that is still a huge problem. I think what I'm seeing is the software. So it's not necessarily new machines. It's new software that can speak to the machines. So for example, there's a company named Topology. They make eyewear that uses a CNC machine, which, like, you know, in the past makes medical devices. But they figured out a way to have like an AR scan of your face to talk to the machines to create custom eyewear. There's also, I'm seeing a lot of companies or a lot of innovation in knitwear. So there's like 3D knitting machines, and they can make just like one sweater at a time, which is really interesting, and it doesn't have as much waste.
Right, right. A word here about the sustainability of this. One of the great things about this, it seems to me, is that you order it when you want it. It's not like the company has to make 42 different sweaters and then you go pick one.
Yeah, that's what's amazing, is because fashion is really concerned now about the sustainability of fashion, and they're starting to really pay attention to not destroying garments. So if you customize a sweater, you're more likely to hold on to it because it is something that you picked out. And then like with the knitwear, there's like very little waste. It's primarily just the yarn that goes into the actual sweater.
So with the caveat that I'm a little bit of a cheapskate, how much is, say, a piece of knitwear going to cost me, or maybe those eyeglasses?
So it's a good question. It's still not the same, you know, fast fashion prices, but those eyeglasses are about $500, which it's still a lot of money. But when you think about eyewear, it's something you wear every day. So that's sort of like worth the investment. The sweaters that we're looking at are less than $200. Like, so I think I paid, I tried one, it was like $100, $120. So that's, for a nice sweater, I think that's comparable.
Were you a satisfied customer?
Definitely. So my Topology eyewear, I actually are my favorite pair. They're the ones that make them out of a CNC machine after they face scan you. And they are far more comfortable than any other eyewear I've ever worn.
Of course, now they've got a scan of your face. I'm just saying.
Okay, well, that is a thing. I think with Instagram and selfies, I think we're past that.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. Probably true. Talk to me more about knitwear, would you, and why it's so well-suited to this sort of enterprise?
So that's really interesting. So basically, sweaters don't have very dense stitches. So the machines, it's cost effective. It doesn't take too much time. Whereas if you're making something like a t-shirt, the stitches are so dense that it would take a lot of time that you wouldn't really, it wouldn't be cost effective. The challenge there, now this is like one of the most interesting things I found out. The challenge is if you speed up the machines, the needles overheat. So you can't just like make the machines faster and faster, which is the same problem you had in computing years ago, right? So now they're trying to increase the number of machines, just like they increase like, you know, the number of servers to make it scalable.
Right. And they eventually fixed the computer overheating problem or you know, have figured out a way to handle it. And so now in 25 years, is this retail as we will know it?
I definitely think it's going to be part of the normal process of retail in the future. I think with the personalization capabilities, the sustainability part, I think it's very promising. I think we're at least maybe 2 to 3 years from it being more mainstream.
Megan McDowell, she's the innovation editor at Vogue Business. Megan, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which one of Apple's biggest shareholders finally gets with the corporate program, Warren Buffett. His holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, owns better than 5% of Apple. He said this morning on CNBC that he has finally traded in his old Samsung flip phone for an iPhone. So good for him, right? But to quote the Oracle of Omaha, you're looking at an 89-year-old guy that's barely beginning to be with it, he said. He also said that he uses the phone mostly as a phone. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 1,031 points, 3.5%. The NASDAQ down 355 points, 3.7%. The S&P 500 off 111, 3.3%. Who knows, though? Could all go the other way tomorrow, right? Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.